Welcome to the Impossible Network, the podcast about everyday people living extraordinary lives. Each week, we explore how their upbringing affected them, how creativity fueled them, and how serendipity guided them.
Since the election, we've had more discussions about, I think, immigration issues, about certainly assault issues that are related to Me Too, and also that more men coming forward as well, trying to work through their own histories and trying to figure out and make sense of maybe murky or ambiguous encounters that they've had in their life too.
This week's guest is Dr. Courtney Reneke, founder of Reneke Associates, a Manhattan-based psychotherapy practice that provides treatments for children, teens, and adults dealing with anxiety, depression, bipolar disorders, and post-adoption issues. As a Massachusetts-born and Columbia University-trained clinical psychologist, Courtney has a mission to offer her patients personalized, pragmatic, and progressive therapies that help them understand their stories and deal with their darkest moments in order to form stronger connections with themselves and with others. She travels internationally to train and coach mental health professionals, parents, and organizations about how attachment-based principles can improve the quality of their lives and the culture of their groups. In this episode, we discuss how Courtney's early upbringing influenced her decision to follow a path in psychotherapy. We discuss her first-hand experience of the psychological effects of the current political and social climate, what we can learn from other countries' more balanced representation of race and gender, the neurological impact of neglect or abuse, and the necessity for human connection, and there's a lot more. I hope you enjoy this thought-provoking discussion with Dr. Courtney Reneke. Welcome, Courtney.
I'm really glad to be here.
So I'd like to begin with your childhood and growing up.
Dangerous question to be asking a psychologist, Mark.
it's an important and obvious question to be asking a psychologist, I think. I'd like to begin with your childhood and growing up then. How did your family's social environment set you on your path to being a psychotherapist and an entrepreneur?
Mm-hmm. On the psychotherapy end, I really credit that to my mom. And my dad too, maybe in a different way, but I think my mom in that when we were growing up, she had trained initially as a nurse, then as a Montessori school teacher, I think was a real seeker of kind of understanding other people in her own way and in her own journey. She then like kind of throughout the course of my lifetime really set herself upon, you know, a lot of different kind of spiritual kind of journeys and pathways, but she was always kind of seeking, was always kind of curious to understand. And I think because she was coming from a very strict Irish Catholic upbringing, I think that by default, she was kind of always trying to understand things in a different way. So that was always, whether it was never labeled psychotherapy, the word psychology I'd never heard of before, really. Even before I got to college, really, I knew it was a course in college, but it wasn't really anything that was in the house. But I think there was a sensitivity because of my mother's kind of nursing, early childhood kind of spiritual journey that was just a part of kind of a drumbeat that was in the house, this kind of curiosity about things. So I think that's kind of that's the psychotherapy part.
Was there anything specifically about what she did that led you to become interested in it? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people have parents that lead a career and go off in a completely different direction.
Yeah.
There must have been something.
I think it was honestly more, my mom and my brother and I were all kind of night owls, and we used to have these chats at the top of the stairs, late at night. And I think those chats always centered around kind of talking about our day and talking about the people in our family, but kind of from an emotionally intelligent kind of perspective on things. And so I think my mom, I could always tell, really enjoyed those conversations. I think that my brother probably remembers them fondly too. He's now going into the field in a different way. He just got his master's in social work. So there's something I think about those top of the stair conversations late at night in the Reneke household.
Your mother certainly had an impact.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your father. In what different way did he have an impact?
I think, my dad grew up in a family where his father was an alcoholic, and my grandmother suffered from very severe anxiety, was an agoraphobic. And I think just his kind of candor and honesty and reflecting on his family, because we would go down, his parents were the closest family that lived to us. We didn't live near any of my mom or dad's family. So we used to see them more often than my mom's family. They were a big deal to us as kids. But I think as we got older, my grandfather, when I met him, was sober, but was in AA. So we would go over their house and there'd be like these AA meetings breaking up, and there'd be these strange, adults giving me the, you know, the AA cards that, you
you're
know,
being one, so, you're being socialized.
I was being totally socialized. So I think, you know, my grandmother in that sense, that she was somebody that, you know, she later got very involved with Al-Anon and ended up doing substance abuse counseling at a steel mill in Connecticut. So I think that that was around, but I think that it was really my dad's just kind of candor and kind of understanding his life and his childhood. And those discussions, I think, also used to kind of sparked my interest about putting pieces together of people's lives about what's seen and not seen.
Being an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. As well, because you have your own business. Yeah. I think you believe you have a 12-person practice.
Yes.
In Lower Manhattan, in Tribeca.
Yes, we do.
What is it that instilled that desire, that ambition, and also probably the work ethic that's required yeah. to take on such a big challenge?
Yeah. I would say, you know, I think if it goes to work ethic, it goes very directly to my dad. You know, he... growing up, you know, there's like these kind of mythical stories about him building these rock walls in our house in New England out in the sweltering, you know, 90 degree heat and humidity in the middle of August, like when no one would even dare go outside. You know, he just growing up was really dogged and was...
Is he Irish as well?
He does have some Irish in him, yeah, but he is German and Russian... has a Russian Jewish background as well, as kind of a German Irish Catholic and a Russian Jewish background. So that's where he's coming from. And I think also coming from, as I was mentioning, his upbringing, things were pretty chaotic. And so I think he got the idea that he could work himself out of the chaos and has done and continues to do, because he's still working full time incredibly well for himself. So I think that I kind of walk humbly behind in his work ethic shoes, as it comes to work ethic part of things.
Having that element of self-belief to yeah. set up your business, to take yeah. a leap from just going into a normal practice.
Yeah.
Who's been the greatest influence on that sense yeah. of self-belief?
I don't know that there's one person, but I think that it is, I think it really duly an enormous debt of gratitude goes to my parents for being, I think, equally and kind of incredibly just had a lot of faith in me. And I think throughout my life, not just as an adult and as a professional, I think trusted me to do the right thing and to kind of be able to pull things off. Even when, you know, when I look back on it now, I really feel like, you know, even when I was in high school, my mom trusted myself and a couple girlfriends to take the family car down to South Carolina for spring break once. I mean, I don't know how she possibly could have put so much faith in us, but I think that there's just this sense that they had, I think, for me and for my brother, that we would kind of were capable people. And I think let us take risks that might make big mistakes, but just had this
kind
of... You
think that was conscious on their part?
I think that it really was. I know it's something that was discussed, and I think particularly for my mom, it was a little bit of a reaction of kind of having maybe a bit of overprotective parents, or parents who, you know, loved her very much, but I think didn't necessarily send her the direct message of like, you can go out in the world and do anything. So I think that, you know, I think part of it really was kind of a conscious correction to that kind of an upbringing. And I think for my dad, it was more, he was just kind of used to him being a capable operator in the world. And I think didn't really like the idea of kind of being overprotective of us. I think he wanted us to know we could go out and make it and, you know, get through hard times and figure ourselves out in the world.
It's a good combination.
Yeah.
In terms of genes to have.
It's not bad. Yeah. Yeah. Lucky.
I'd mentioned that you've built your own 12-person psychotherapy practice mm-hmm. In Tribeca.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was Soho and you just recently moved. You also travel the world training and coaching.
Yeah.
I'd like to understand if there was any serendipitous experience or encounter or person mm-hmm. that impacted or affected the direction of your journey.
Yeah.
And what you've achieved to date.
Yeah, sure. There's probably a number of people. You know, I think in terms of, you know, because there's the training and then there's the content of the training. And so I think that, you know, how I got, I train in a model with a horribly jargony entitled name, which is dyadic developmental psychotherapy. And essentially that is an attachment focused family therapy that was originally developed by a man named Dan Hughes, who worked with a lot of kids in foster care and adoptees in Maine originally. And so how I got to that was completely serendipitous in terms of that the first psychotherapy case I ever had as a trainee now over like 18 years ago was a little girl who was adopted. And she really stayed with me because I felt like at the time, even though I had really bright, smart supervisors where I went to school at Columbia, I never felt that we were able to really kind of really help her and her mom evolve in having the kind of relationship that they both wanted and address some of the issues now that I understand to be more around attachment issues directly through the kind of play therapy that we were doing. So I think that she was really integral to kind of start me down this intellectual, but what has become a very emotional kind of, you know, existential kind of journey of working with adopted families and working with foster care agencies and people working in foster care.
So this first case, this little girl, you weren't using, you call it
dyadic developmental
psychology.
Dyadic developmental
DDP.
DDP. Yeah.
So you weren't using DDP at that point in time.
No, I wasn't.
What therapy were you using?
So I was trained at Columbia, and initially I was working in a more psychodynamic kind of play therapy model, which would be, you know, was more non-directive, where you let the child kind of choose different materials and play things in the room, toys and other things. Sometimes it's done with sand trays and figures, but essentially to kind of, they create and play out internal dramas is essentially kind of the thinking behind it. So I wasn't using that at the time. It was really child-led and certainly, you know, explored a lot of the things that she appeared to be thinking about that, you know, she would replicate over and over again. She came from an orphanage, so she would pack a dollhouse room full of babies. There's other elements of her internal life that I think got expressed, but her mom was still stressed out and felt like she couldn't figure out this mix of this, her daughter's kind of over clinginess with her and then rejection of her. And I think the little girl had no understanding of what the early impact of being separated from her biological family and this adoption, which was also a transracial adoption. And there was certainly not any discussion directly for the mom and the kid about understanding the differences in their race and their background. So they're just, I felt like there just wasn't, there wasn't enough that I did to help this little girl and her family.
So what was the leap to DDP from there?
So the leap was kind of a long and winding road through different training and experiences. And it was actually, you know, my mentor and at university was, you know, probably also very crucial in my kind of development as a psychotherapist. She was the first psychologist I'd ever met, and I think was really instrumental in helping me feel like, I think if my parents gave me some foundation of self-confidence, I think she really gave me the idea that I could really do this psychotherapy bit. Mm-hmm. But she had introduced me to this book and by Dan Hughes and had encouraged me to go to one of his trainings, which I did kind of while I was finishing up my training as a postdoc. Was the first year that I'd encountered him and this idea about kind of attachment-focused family therapy work.
And that set you on the direct path.
And that set me on this path. And I think, you know, I'd like to think I also have maybe some, you know, internal valence and kind of traction for it, because I think that really walking that walk is about being transparent, being open, trying to be vulnerable and clear with your clients, for me, with my staff, with my supervisees, really being focused on creating a real relationship with people in the context of psychotherapy. So she set me on the path, and I'd like to think I had a little traction inside for it.
What I'm trying to understand is you went down that journey, but other psychotherapy practices don't embrace it. Yes. Or they do embrace it, or is it?
I think it's just not well known. I think that, you know, my hope is that maybe now, because there's so much more going on with affective neuroscience, it's this kind of incredible field of us being better able to understand the brain. And as we're understanding the brain and how it develops, I think we're getting more and more models are getting closer to kind of how DDP operates. But I think that psychotherapy, because we started out with this idea of Freud and psychoanalysis, and I think the big backlash against that was that there's no evidence, there's no randomized controlled trials from a medical model perspective. There just wasn't enough research and data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, DDP is a newer model. We're still in the process of gathering evidence and research about our model. Although we would say that there's a robust amount of data from over 50 years of attachment theory. But I think that that's why most programs are either psychodynamic in some way and kind of have an older tradition, or are primarily evidence-based and really are not open to tend not to be open to newer models of psychotherapy.
You mentioned neuroscience and technology and how it's advancing dramatically. Do you foresee a time in the next maybe 10 years where there'll be a strong integration between sort of neuroscience and technology applied to allow you to deliver a better measurement and metrics in terms of the impact of your therapies?
If I'm just being frank, in some ways, I should be like a lot more interested in impact. And I guess I am on a one-to-one basis. I think where my interest in neuroscience is much more around better understanding how do we help people soothe themselves? How do we help people regulate? How does that happen? And I think that there's potentially in some of these kind of what I would call kind of adjunctive therapies, things like brain spotting or neurofeedback, some of which are kind of older technologies, but there's some thinking about how do we directly influence the brain to heal itself before we're even getting to psychotherapy. That for a lot of the kids that I see, and also really for a lot of the adults that I work with, we're so reliant on words to heal things that there might be a more direct impact and way to kind of create different feedback loops with technology in the future. Mm-hmm. That to me is really, really exciting. The idea even, you know, that there is a researcher, his name is Stephen Porges, who has a theory called the polyvagal theory, just full of fun terms for you today.
Yeah.
Sounds great. But he has kind of a mechanism called Safe and Sound that he's been working on for a very long time that essentially just through audio tone kind of communicates to the brain to get into a state of open engagement. And the idea is kind of to use this audio protocol prior to a psychotherapy session so that that the child is coming into the room in an open and engaged state versus defensive. Because you could think of 10,000 different reasons why as an adult or as a kid, you'd be feeling a little bit tense and nervous walking into your therapist's office. As a kid, it's like, oh, here we go again. I'm going to be in trouble. People are going to be talking about all my problems. And for an adult, it would be like, oh, here we go again. I'm going to walk into a therapist's office and they're going to talk about my problems. So I think I'm more interested on how, as we're understanding the brain, what are some of the kind of core features to help us get soothing, get calm, get in states that prime people towards engagement, meaning that what we know, because human beings are social animals, that, you know, brains work best together when they feel like the other person is a person who is a safe person. Like we're chatting. I don't know you just as an interviewer, but I know you socially as well. And so I probably have more safety in the room with you to share my life circumstances than I would with a stranger. Right.
Of course. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I suppose when you talk about adjunctive therapies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things like mindfulness practice as
fantastic.
Well would also be an important
1,000%. 1,000%. And we know that those are things that directly target the brain without words, right?
Okay, we like to talk to our guests about creativity and sure. challenging conventions. Psychotherapy as a practice doesn't exactly spring to mind when you talk about creativity and challenging conventions.
No.
So I will ask you the question. I mean, how does creativity and unconventional thinking manifest mm-hmm. itself in your business and maybe your method of working that you've just been discussing?
I think...
Or it could even be in terms of managing your team of other therapists.
Sure. So, you know, I think that probably... my openness to maybe going a slightly less conventional path. I mean, there's a lot about me that's also very conventional, but I think in terms of following these kind of newer treatments and newer approaches, I think probably, you know, starts with a little bit of, you know, I think that my dad was someone who kind of liked to buck convention. I think he always kind of felt a little bit like an outsider within, you know, kind of like a blue collar guy in the middle of a white collar world. And so I've, you know, had a certain magnet for other mentors in my life. Like my first boss when I was a postdoc was also really instrumental in kind of shaking me loose from this idea that, you know, a psychotherapy practice had to be such a kind of a slave to academia, and also really instilling, speaking of confidence from our prior question, I think instilled some confidence that like, you have this degree, you've done this training, like you can do this and you don't have to do it maybe in the way that the treatment manuals say. You can go out and trust yourself as a clinician to kind of figure things out. So I think that was maybe the first part. The kind of influential figures of how I set up my business. And I think now, you know, I hope to instill that also in my staff, that I think that they're also tend to be coming from graduate programs where, you know, for good reason, I think there's a lot of supervision that communicates, you know, that more experienced licensed people have to help you make decisions when you're first learning. That's to ensure the safety and good treatment for everybody. But I think there's a way that it tends to start to get into people's psyche that they don't feel confident, that even after people think they see these big degrees and they think, oh, you must feel like you really know something. And usually if you talk to people graduating from a PhD program, at least in clinical psychology, they'd say, no, I don't know anything. I need to check in with this person, or this person's the expert, or this person's the expert. And I certainly have great reverence for people who have expertise, but I think I like to instill in staff, like, drop into yourself and have a gut sense of what you know how to do. Yeah.
So that's interesting. It just gets me thinking about how you judge success and failure.
Yeah.
And how there's two elements to it.
Yeah.
What is success and failure in relation to patients? Because you're taking them on a journey of transformation
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also that attitude.
Yep.
And those characteristics that are displayed by people coming out of that.
Yeah.
When you mention someone with a PhD, you'd expect them to be incredibly confident.
Yep.
Prepared to take risks.
That's
to experiment, to explore new avenues.
Right.
And that's not something you encounter. How do you foster an environment or a culture of, and I accept when I use the word risk taking, there's a limit to how much risk you can take
mm-hmm.
in treating them
sure.
and exploring new therapies or new forms of treatment.
Right.
But there must be an element given your entrepreneurial spirit
and
you're bringing new staff in.
Yeah.
How do you guide them and coach them?
Sure. Well, I think
And support them. In taking these risks and making tiny failures.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I know that like safety is a way overused word, but I'll use it. I'll maybe define it really specifically for what is the type of safety. I think when I was saying before, when I'm trying to work relationally with my staff as well and be transparent and vulnerable with them, I think that safety for my staff to take risks comes from the fact that each one of them, they could argue, maybe they don't feel this way, but my hope is that they know exactly how I feel about them. They know when I think they're struggling or maybe they need more support, and they know when I really think that they're doing a good job and why. And I think a lot of those, you know, people call them kind of like candid conversations, don't happen. I think people avoid conflict in this culture because we don't have a lot of practice with, you know, rupture and repair.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do a lot of kind of direct conversation with my staff, that's not, it's not about being confrontational, but it's more in the stance of, I care about you and I'm worried about X, Y, and Z. And I know you're going to have feelings about that because you think you might think that you're doing X, Y, and Z really, really well, but I'm worried about how it's going. And let's talk about it, because what I want for you is to get the support you need to grow. And I think that so often in our professional lives, we're constantly trying to scrape things together to kind of put on our best face and not show any cracks in our armor. And I think that I have to kind of establish that that transparency, that baseline for people to be vulnerable, to admit when things are going poorly, for them to actually really get it when they're doing things really, really well.
That's an interesting leadership technique that's grounded in empathy. Yeah. I was interviewing Michael Ventura from Sub Rosa.
Fantastic.
He's written a book called Applied Empathy, and what you're talking about there embraces a lot of the principles.
Absolutely.
Where did that leadership style come from?
It came from my work with DDP.
I mean, so it's directly related to the therapy.
Directly related. I think it's that, and I think there's another also horribly titled adult... It's horribly titled, but incredible therapy that I love, called Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy.
Don't ask me to repeat that.
But I'm sure your marketing brain is just exploding with that. No, but I think it comes from those models, and those come from attachment theory. Empathy, and really what it is to stand and to be, feel with people, is kind of just some of the things that are just very core about us as people. And I think that those terms get really bastardized and confused, I think, in the culture at large. But I think when you're really in them, it takes two people to be kind of vulnerable where things are at. To feel with somebody means opening your heart up to whatever they're feeling, which is not something that we do regularly, I think. We can't do it all the time anyway.
Given that you've got this dualism in terms of the DDP application of the treatment for your patients and also directing it internally for your team.
Yeah.
Are you doing any work with organizations or businesses where you can apply that in a way to both give leadership training within the businesses and also help solve internal conflicts and management issues?
Yeah, I mean, that's our hope, is that that's the next place to go. I think that, you know, when you were alluding to these trainings that I've done, I've been fortunate to be able to travel to Kenya and the UK and the Czech Republic and the Netherlands and New Zealand and Australia. And in many of these trainings, I'm training their staff, their clinical staff, their case managers, to train within their agency. And whenever we're doing those trainings, we're not just talking about how to do the psychotherapy, but also how to relate to one another. And, you know, it naturally, the conversations from the supervising staff begin to emerge about how to implement this at an organizational level. So it's definitely the next place I want to go, because I really feel passionate about how, I think you were kind of asking me before, kind of what are, you know, how do I see success in my business? And I think one of them is just the felt sense of community that I have with my team. You know, being a psychologist is really lonely. In some way, it's really rich, and then it's really lonely when you leave your room, because there's not the same sense. You don't walk outside your door. You can't tell anybody about how your day's gone.
Of course,
really,
yeah.
You know. So having this team of people and this sense of community, I think I feel really good about, and I would love to help other organizations take on what's actually very challenging work to be a bit more bolder and braver, and you know, embrace their vulnerability and lead from that place of strength.
So leading, taking the lead from the TV show Billions.
Yeah.
So a Wendy-esque sort of role
inside
an organization.
But Wendy rarely, you know, Wendy is very direct, but I think that that show, I think people have asked me, you know, to kind of, even at one point, someone asked me actually to be, can you be Wendy for me? But I think, you know, I love the show. It's super fun to watch. But I think that also so much of what she's doing is about getting people back up and going to perform. Mm-hmm. And that's fantastic when that happens. And I think that that can happen best. But I think often there's a little bit of, there's not a good intention for people's best self at best coming out. It's often what's in best service of the bottom of the line. Business. Yeah.
But the individual benefit of having some form of, not necessarily using the word therapy,
yeah,
but having someone within the organization mm-hmm. to discuss their concerns,
sure.
have a safe environment
totally.
To express their fears, their anxieties.
Right.
Surely that does then lead to them feeling more satisfied and therefore as themselves, the satisfaction and motivation will be reflected in better performance, whatever the task they're doing.
That's what I believe too. So, and I think like, if you probably know this data better than I do, but you know, when you look at retention for companies, it's not money, it's culture. Mm-hmm. It's relationships, you know.
And feeling that you've got a purpose.
And you've got a purpose.
And that you're recognized.
Yep.
As well. And listened to.
Absolutely. So it would be both. I think that the thing that's tricky about being a Wendy is I think there's a role of kind of how to engender that with individual staff. But I think for me, looking at an organization, it's really about how do you transform leadership to take this on? How do you train the leaders in the organization to take this approach on? Because I think you can do it one off with people, mm-hmm. but unless the culture supports these kinds of conversations, these kinds of ways of being with each other, I think that people can get shut down in this process really quickly. And I think even in people think that, people would work in mental health or in a foster care agency or an outpatient psychotherapy practice, they must be so psychologically minded with each other. Well, no, we're just human beings. And I think, you know, people's feelings get hurt or pride gets stepped on or don't feel like that they have purpose or meaning in the group. And I think it gets missed unless you're really thinking relationally about the people that you're working with.
I used to do some work when I was working at a big agency, McCann, with a great client, IKEA.
Okay.
And IKEA, we had a lot of time spent using in reflection. And often reflection happened after projects or during projects mm-hmm. to discuss, you know, what was working, to have essentially round tables where people would get out their thoughts, their concerns, their frustrations. And I found it a very productive and constructive way of working.
Absolutely.
And I think it is very much a Swedish way. And it feels as there's strong crossover and elements of DDP. And one sort of just a little bit of observation and maybe feedback for people in the psychological circles. Maybe there's a branding problem with DDP. It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
No.
And maybe if you are taking this into the corporate world, maybe you just have to come up with a different terminology for it.
I believe so. We might be in discussion on that later, Mark. I totally agree.
But it does feel like there's a real opportunity there, particularly in the need for companies to sort of transform and create. Yeah. As you say, it's probably an overused word, these safe environments, and it's misinterpreted a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think especially when you're dealing within an attachment context, and I think that attachment now is becoming a little bit more mainstream in that I think that there's now like some dating sites that are using it and people are getting some sense that like, oh, every human being on the planet has an attachment style. We have a way we feel and deal with things and internal stresses, external stresses in the world that comes from just our experiences when we were younger.
So given that we're living in this hyper-connected, technologically, socially connected world where we're feeling as a society, and certainly all the evidence is there of people sensing depression, disconnection, isolation, even in the workplace.
Yep.
There has to be some intervention, surely, and this type of treatment or leadership or management style could be the answer to that.
I really agree. And I think we look at things like the Minister of Loneliness for the UK, we look at the skyrocketing rates of anxiety and depression in teenagers, the, you know, extremely troubling increased rates of suicide completion that are happening now that appear not to be statistical artifacts, but appear to be kind of part and parcel of the world that we're living in right now. I absolutely think that interventions around really understanding even how does technology fit into relationships. I was just listening to Ezra Klein's podcast. He was talking about the digital divide and that really the difference is based on wealth, but it's not what we thought. everybody seems to have screens, but it's wealthier folks who have extra support to help their kids get off of screens and into relationship and back to kind of more anachronistic, you know,
particularly
activities.
Particularly sort of founders of very successful Silicon Valley tech companies.
Yes, absolutely.
Probably the best example.
Absolutely. Who are very, very vocal about it, right?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that, again, it's, you know, it's not just being off a screen doesn't necessarily lead to good connection, but it's the start. And I think thinking about, you know, we just derive so much meaning from our relationships, you know?
I'm preparing for an interview with a ADD sufferer, mm-hmm. and I'm reading his book at the moment and due for an interview with him called yeah. Ryder Carroll, creator of the Bullet Journal. And Ryder created the Bullet Journal as an antidote. Mm-hmm. Or sort of journaling as yeah. an antidote to his suffering
yeah.
He took upon himself
yeah.
and to turn to pen and paper.
Right.
And as a, funnily enough, as a digital product designer, was turning away from technology, but going
right.
back to old school
right.
analog, sort of, let's say, technology,
yeah.
pen and paper, to journal
yeah.
as a way to, I think the way he describes it, declutter his mind
mm-hmm.
and to cultivate his curiosity and remain more focused, which mm-hmm. obviously as an ADD sufferer
yeah,
is a primary
yeah,
reason. But
yeah.
what he talks about is it's really led him to this conclusion that it allows you to create or allows you to live a more intentional life. And he
yeah.
calls it intentionality.
Right.
So rather than living or just enduring life
right.
and just drifting along, reacting,
mm-hmm.
it allows you to be more proactive, I suppose.
Yes.
And the way I think he terms it is tracking your past, ordering your present, and designing your future. So he's just to go on a slight tangent,
yeah.
that idea you're talking about of getting away from technology and getting
right.
away from screens that Ezra Klein was
yeah.
talking about, presumably journaling is a good example of that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think journaling's a good example of that. And, you know, even... you know, I can remember that there's maybe even a little bit of kind of a subtle kind of relational piece to journaling, or there can be, in the sense of, you know, even when you are organizing something for yourself, you know, there's been studies that just writing things down, getting your story out, you know, in certain kind of maybe specific research paradigms, even when you're turning something in, even though there's no guarantee that anyone's going to read it, that there's some imagined audience,
mm-hmm.
that there's some dialogue with kind of an internal other, I don't know. I would just say that there's, it's about making meaning, and it's about turning away from technology. But I would just say that there's also maybe just some subtle implied kind of relational activity in journaling. It's very solitary, but who are you writing to? Yourself,
yeah.
your best self, your hopeful self? Is it, you know, I think getting things out that can't be said to certain people. I mean, I think that there really is a kind of, it's a really powerful, it can be a very powerful communication to say the things you can't say to people.
So Courtney, you describe on your site as part of your treatment is helping adults, children and families understand their stories to help form stronger connections. Can you just expand a bit more on what
sure.
you mean by
sure.
understanding their stories?
So, yeah, I think stories and having a story is really important on two levels with the families that I work with very often, because these kids who are coming out of foster care or are international adoption, where they might have been in an institution or an orphanage. There are huge pieces of their life that we just take for granted that are not there. When was my birth date? Where was I actually born? What were the circumstances of it? Who is my birth mother, my birth father? There's huge, huge, huge gaps in actual information. So it's really important to start to weave together. We do things called timelines with them or life books with them, which, you know, are very often done working with this population. However, I think the thing that's different about the way that we approach it is that we understand it's not just knowing the facts of your story. It's processing the loss and it's alleviating the shame that's related to it. So that our ultimate goal for these kids and for these families is to be able to hold their head up high and claim their entire story. Because for so many of them, just by the fact that their birth parents did not decide to raise them, injects them, maybe with, I thinking back to earlier in this conversation where I was talking about how lucky I was to have parents who believed in me. Mm. And I'm so lucky that I had that. And I think this is the opposite sensation, which really is a felt experience. It's not logical, which is someone did not want me. And the echoes of that.
Does this apply to single parent families as well as adoptive children?
Sure. Because there's always, we are as human beings always monitoring loss. And it could be a single parent family. It could be a family where there's both parents present, but one is emotionally unavailable or is struggling with addiction, is not emotionally present. You know, that it can be, it's not just for adoptive families. This is a model that also works with biological families where, you know, we just as human beings, we monitor all the time. Are you there? Are you interested in me? And when you're not, usually the kind of automatic assumption that you jump to as a child is there is something wrong with me, because it's far scarier to assume there's something wrong with the adults that are caring for me.
I was in Philly, mm-hmm. South Philly, mm-hmm. Philadelphia, mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago, interviewing Tyreek Glasgow, who is a reformed drug dealer and imprisoned and now back in the streets of South Philly, mm-hmm. helping disadvantaged youth really transform their life through sport and art.
Wow.
And it's an incredible sort of story what he's doing with the support of the local mayor's office and DA's office.
It's
really impressive. But he talked about his youth and his pain and his suffering and that he went through from a broken home and living with his grandmother. Didn't really talk too much about his mother or father, but also just the pain and the suffering that a lot of these kids are dealing with on the streets.
Absolutely.
And that's obviously what you're dealing with
Absolutely.
And what you're seeing.
Absolutely. And there's a thing, you know, I think that people, when they hear that, there's still maybe some people who kind of give a little eye roll to that. But when we are neglected, when, you know, in terms of what we now understand what our brain does with that, is that that is a social, our brain registers that as social rejection. If you're a kid and you're trying to reach out to people for support and you're getting either nothing or you're getting abuse, it's registered as social pain. What our brain does with that is numb it out. Mm-hmm. And it can be on the parenting end of things too. So it's like this pain often gets kind of buffered by drugs, violence, noise, chaos, because it is our bodies and our nervous system get wired not to feel those things, because they're so central to it's kind of like life or death to feel like you are connected and that there are adults in your life that think that you're important and want to take care of you.
And I suppose the antidote to or the reaction to that sort of that lack, that pain, that suffering, mm-hmm. that lack of connection is obviously, as you say, you're drawn into sort of drugs and addiction. Yeah. But equally, as Tyreek said, there's going to be a guy in the street corridor going, "Hey, what do you need?"
Yeah.
And suddenly you're in that gang and you're part of that crew.
And you have meaning and you have connection and you have people looking out for you. And if you haven't had that, there's the idea of it and the feeling of it. It's just like our brains just seek support. We'll get it any way we can. We'll get it from people who actually are hurting us. It doesn't matter. We'll get it any way we can. Yeah.
Okay, Courtney, I want to come to another question, but we might just have to pause for a break.
Sure.
I'll run down to get a little glass of wine. It's Friday afternoon.
Let's please do that.
For a minute. Okay.
Good that you caught it then, though, Mark.
I know.
Yeah.
Right, so Courtney, I'm going to ask you a timely question.
Okay.
It's a nice segue. Clearly, we're living through very challenging times.
Yeah, to say the
both
least.
Culturally, politically, economically, and obviously climate change aside. But you must be dealing with and feeling and seeing the pain that people are experiencing at the harder end mm-hmm. of society mm-hmm. firsthand. So let's just say a big what if. What if you were given the keys to the mayor's office? Even better, we give you the keys to the White House. 2020 is coming around.
Yeah.
What would you start with changing?
Before I maybe go to the what if, I mm-hmm. do maybe want to kind of just state, because I feel like it's hard just to jump to that without naming some part of my lens, my group practices lens of what's been happening over the past couple years of the administration, but particularly what's been going on since the Kavanaugh hearings back this fall, which is that we've been inundated with mostly women, but there's new stories or new admissions of times of being hurt, assaulted, sexually assaulted, and raped and harassed since Yeah, sorry.
Sorry. No, I just want to say, is this also aligned with the Me Too movement as well?
Aligned with Me Too. And I think what I think that since the election, we've had more discussions about, I think, immigration issues, about certainly assault issues that are related to Me Too, and also that more men coming forward as well, trying to work through their own histories and trying to figure out and make sense of maybe murky or ambiguous encounters that they've had in their life too. And so I don't want to discount, you know, the men that are in our practice and who are trying to work that through. Mm-hmm. And we're always kind of talking about how do we leave the door open and stay engaged with men and partner with men and ally with men who are trying to work this out and figure this out too. But I guess I'll just say, since the Kavanaugh hearings, it's not been just Me Too. There was something about those hearings that really just set off a whole other cascade of admissions of things that had happened many years or more recently, but wow. things that, I mean, there was a point at which my staff was just saying, I've just gone back to back to back with three clients that have been working with me for quite some time, all three with new memories of things, not found memories, but just things they'd never reported, never said, that there's just been something that I guess it just feels like it bears mentioning.
I'm intrigued. Why do you think it triggered such a visceral reaction?
I mean, I don't have a scientific reason for it. I can only speak for myself, because I think that it also made me reflect on my own history and my own experiences. And I think it certainly made me, it kind of opened up a whole well of emotion that I think I'd kind of put to the side about some of my own experiences in my life. I just think there was something so incredibly powerful about Christine Blasey Ford and her testimony. And I think just so many women and men too, I'm speaking primarily of women here, but I don't want to leave them out as well, could just relate to, there's something that happened to me that was really scary and really troubling. And I had to move it aside and move on with my life. And I did, but I had to kind of block out some of the pain about that situation. Not every instance of sexual assault, sexual harassment, or rape results in PTSD or brings people into mental health services. People were built to get on with their lives. However, the experiential quality of that, I think, is another matter. And I think people are just came back into contact with rage, with fear, with just unresolved issues that they wanted to work through. So I just feel like I wanted to maybe add some important, maybe context to that question. Mm-hmm. It's almost like I have so many thoughts about what's going on in our country right now. It's really hard to organize them. The thing that comes to mind is maybe feels jumping from that kind of more painful contextual issue to the politics might just feel a little bit superficial, but it mm-hmm. makes me think of places like Iceland and even in Kenya, where they've legislated things like half of the legislature has to be women. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that women are the only solution, but I do think we can have maybe open the conversation too about some affirmative action generally around gender and around race in our representation. Our legislatures do not reflect the gender makeup and racial makeup of our country. And I think when it's so discrepant, I just think it leads to, you know, there's going to be, when there's power, there's corruption. There'll be, you know, I'm not saying that women are perfect, or that if we're thinking about this even more in terms of other lines of identity, it's not always a perfect solve. But I think it if I could flip a switch, when you look at what happened in Iceland, for example, mm-hmm. They made a decision after kind of, I believe it was in the 70s, where they started to kind of put ratios. Yeah. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah. I know the story, yeah.
Yeah. So obviously we're a far more heterogeneous population than Iceland is, but it just makes me think, like, there's so many things we're going to have to work through to heal, to try to heal. I don't know if it's going to be possible to heal. I don't want to be Pollyannish about just the damage that is being done and is currently occurring in the country.
But you must also feel optimistic given the midterms and the amount of women that actually been elected and the age of some of these people as well, and a new generation totally. Coming. So change.
But you know, when you say that, it makes me feel like this, if I'm being honest, I also feel this burst of like, like, dude, it was like, we have to like jump up and down for 24%. You know, we didn't even get a full quarter and we're, and yeah, it's historic. And yes, change is slow, but I guess I just feel like, you know, after the lecture, after the midterms, I was really excited about, and also just also that it's not just gender wise, but also the diversity in terms of women of different religious backgrounds, sexual orientation, you know, that ethnic backgrounds that made first. I think all those things are exciting. I just think it's so, it's just crazy to me that it's 2018 and we're so far off the ball game in terms of, representation that's proportional to the population of this country. It's bonkers.
Yeah. No, it's true in politics. It's true in business. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. I feel like we've repaired because
I mentioned there was an event here at Neuhaus about a month ago where Seth Godin stood up and talked and spoke to the, and he said, made this comment about, please stop talking about the resistance. You're not the resistance. You're the trend.
Yeah.
The resistance is the government.
That's right.
It's not just government. It's the anyone holding the reins of power, whether it be in big business or whether it be in politics or be in religion. It's people trying to resist change. And let's face it, we know
we're
that
really
most
terrified
people
of it.
Fear change.
Yes,
but change is coming. So it's optimistic.
Now
but,
we've really repaired, Mark. Now I feel much better about the whole thing.
I'm glad. Well, maybe we just need to get you thinking about 2020.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I want to get into some quick fire questions.
Sure.
What principles do you stand by?
I guess integrity around... trying to stand in integrity about acting in the world in a way that's consistent with my emotional truth. So that's maybe, I mean, it's maybe one for a lot of people, but having my insides match my outsides and, taking the risks, that need to happen in order for that to occur.
Okay. What hard choices have you had to make that might have been tough at the time, but have actually turned out to be the right decision in the end?
I guess, you know, it's funny. Something just jumped over. I don't have one in particular. I guess I just feel like that there's probably a million hard choices in relationships. Mm-hmm. If I was going to be really honest, I think that I've been thinking lately about kind of the course of my life or even just in this trajectory of kind of business and entrepreneurship. And I think, you know, there's probably a point at which with a very old boyfriend that I probably would have gone the course of marriage, but none of this would have none of my life would have happened. And I often think about it because he's a really wonderful person. And I don't know that he ever thought that, but I kind of think that we were with each other for very long, knew each other for a very long time. It likely would have gone in that direction. My life would have been really different. And I think ending that relationship in totality was probably a really hard decision and oddly set up everything else in my life.
Feels like you've come full circle to the serendipity question.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I'm glad. I think I probably still don't fully understand the serendipity question, but I'm glad that I'm coming full circle to something. Well, yeah.
Maybe that's all part of serendipity.
Yeah.
We're not meant to understand it.
Okay.
Where do you go to discover new ideas?
I think that
can be physical. It can be spiritual.
Yeah.
It can be...
I think it's like, it's probably the hit list is like, there's something that happens. You know, I think it's probably I'm not alone that when I'm traveling and particularly when I'm traveling outside of the country, that I'm so out of my day-to-day context that there's just a lot I can kind of, whether I'm directly questioning it, I'm implicitly kind of questioning it and kind of feel generally more open to thinking about looking at my life kind of literally from the outside, thinking about traveling back and thinking about kind of what I want. But I think that those trips are often done with very good friends. And so I think that whether I'm away or whether I'm home, really good friends that kind of are also really curious and journeying and thinking about their lives, and I feel safe enough emotionally to kind of be candid and honest with, I think that those discussions are also fantastic. And I think sometimes it's like, you know, like that for me, there's like kind of this point in time on Sundays, sometimes when things haven't been so crazy in the week, that Sundays, that kind of that time where either you can kind of get a little bit, have the Sunday blues, or you can be kind of like reflective. I feel like those are also maybe times when new ideas and reflection come into the mix in a good way.
Okay. The final question, Courtney, is what we call the impossible question.
Sure.
From what you've told me, there's a duality. There's one side of your family that was about, there was a history of medics, doctors, nursing.
Yeah, that's the namesake of my group practice in a way. Yeah, my grandfather, Rolf Andreas, who was a doctor.
Fascinating. Yeah. Oh, it's good. Maintaining the family legacy. That's right. Great. On the other side of your family, the father's side, the Norwegian, German, Russian, Irish connection, there was a history of addiction and alcoholism. And as families play out, you could have gone down either route, but you have gone down the positive route.
Yeah.
A journey of possibility to achieve what many people would deem to be impossibility for someone of your background, which is having your own practice, your own business, successful international speaking career and teaching. I'd like your perspective on it, because I know that, you know, there's different journeys and people we've interviewed that have definitely have got an impossible journey, but I'd like your perspective on your own particular struggles, and also any advice you could pass on to anyone else that might be in a similar position to you that you were maybe 20 years ago.
Sure. I mean, I think, while you were giving me that really nice setup, Mark, about my, my successes, it's still kind of, I'm bristling a bit, but I'm just letting it sit as you said it. I think that there are ways in which I am successful. I think that my journey, you know, doesn't feel so impossible in the sense of I had so many advantages. I really did in I think the ways that are most important in terms of love and support. And I think in terms of, you know, I had two parents who broke their own cycles in different ways. My dad being the first in his family to go to, of his immediate family to go to college. And my mom, I think, busting out of her kind of, the expectations of being a good Irish Catholic girl. So I think it's not so impossible in the sense of I have a lot of privilege. And I would say within that, when you look at, even if we're just going back to, if I could be a little bit political about this, I think,
of course,
if you look at the number of white women that voted against their interests or continue to vote against their interests, I still think there is, you know, that there's patriarchy. I still think that there's something about women taking a step forward and taking risks to speak out against potentially and men in their life, and that that men having the last say about who you choose in the election booth, and also maybe about different choices that you might make with career, with money, etc. So I think I'm not building myself up to all of that, but I just think I want to acknowledge the amazing privileges I've had, but I still think there are maybe the things that are difficult are about still trying to do that on a day-to-day basis in my own life of what I was saying earlier of having my outsides match my insides, you know, to try to speak truth to power when I need to, which is still not easy to do. It's just not even as many privileges as I've had. You know, I can think of a very recent situation where it was still really difficult to speak up to, you know, somebody who is in power, who is male, who I didn't agree with something that this person did. So I don't think that's necessarily, I don't know how successful I feel at doing those things, but it's certainly something I aspire to and is maybe the only context I would say that it's, I think like there were many people along the way who I think kind of helped me shake loose of being kind of a quote unquote nice white girl. And I think the world needs maybe more like, you know, white girls who are ready to get messy.
Okay.
What
would your advice be to someone 20 years to get messy? And
I think it is about, you know, it goes back to, I think maybe watching some of my staff in their development too. I think of part of, I think, in a very kind of political, kind of cultural sense about being, again, people can really disagree with this, but I think about being a white woman is a lot of the privilege is derived from pleasing people and not shaking the boat. And I think that there, that it's okay to shake the boat, that there is, I think, to live in a kind of integrity where you're trying to kind of speak up for yourself and speak your own truth and not necessarily please everybody in the room. I think, you know, regardless of gender and regardless of race or background, it's still something I think we're all trying to do, is just kind of to live your own life. But I think I can only speak for my own experience. And I think there's something about with white girls and being too people pleasing. And I think I will think Chaya Murmurstein from my family therapy externship back in Beth Israel, who was basically like, you know, stop being so nice to all of us. Let's get going. Mm-hmm. Speak the truth. It's okay. You know, and I think there's something still about that that I'm still trying to work on. And I think if we all did collectively, who knows what could, what kind of earthquake could transpire.
Thank you for your honesty, being so candid with your thoughts. A lot of people, when we come to interviews, will be slightly guarded. And although we do have a social connection, I still recognize and appreciate your being candid and honest. Also, I recognize your integrity that comes through in what you say, and also applaud your vulnerability in terms of talking about your own sort of vulnerabilities in your journey, and your passion for what you do.
Yeah.
Really sort of come through, which is amazing. So I wish you all the best in the future of Renike Associates. I look forward to maybe in future episodes catching up.
Well, thank you very much.
About
too.
Where you end up, and a nudge. 2020.
Yeah.
Let's think about it.
Yeah. Sure. Renike 2020.
Exactly. It's got a certain ring to it.
Yeah. Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah,
thanks very much. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, folks. That's it for this week. If you like the show, please subscribe and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps more people discover us. Just go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to subscribe and rate. For now, stay curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.